principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Herbert Bodman teaches history at the University of North Carolina. He specializes in the Middle East and Islam, and he was at the center recently as a visitor. Dr. Bodman, tell me about some of your experiences in travel in the Middle East.
I spent 2 years in Beirut, using Beirut as a base to travel around the region. It was delightful. I had a Ford Foundation fellowship, and one of the things they told me in my interview, now, Mr. Bodman, this is not a fellowship for you to hole yourself up in a library. We want you to go out and travel. Mm-hmm. And that, I said, that's music to my ears. And so I spent about half my time out there traveling for those 2 years. And then I've been back several times since.
Well, I've got some very broad questions for you about history and what you teach and your academic interests. But let's talk now about what you're doing here at the National Humanities Center, the Summer Institute Voyages of Discovery. What specifically are you doing on the faculty?
I'm using Wilfred Thesiger's Arabian Sands as a springboard. He was an Englishman, an eccentric Englishman, as most English travelers certainly were, the kind that went across deserts at least, who crossed the Rub al-Khali, or the Empty Quarter, in 1946 on the excuse of doing a locust research project, which I'm sure he did. But this was simply a vehicle for him, and now I'm using him as a vehicle to talk about the Arabian Peninsula, about the Bedouin and how they differ from other Arabs, how they are really a subcultural group, a group of people who are highly attuned to their environment, who live in the margin of life and are real specialists at it, or were. They hardly exist anymore.
What happens in Arabian Sands?
Well, in Arabian Sands, this is an individual. I think it's quite important that he was born and raised in Ethiopia at the turn of the century. His father was minister there, and he makes a comment in the book that until he was nine, he never knew any children except his brothers. I would presume that means any British children. And he then goes to a grammar school in England and hates it. And he seems to be a loner. He seems to be a person who never really had any close friends, and preferred to be alone, and wanted to take these trips in faraway places, not the places that one usually thinks of. For example, the Empty Quarter of Arabia, where he spent about 2 or 3 years, then the marshes of southern Iraq, where again you have a people who are very closely attuned to their environment. And then his most recent book, The Lost Nomad, speaks of further travels that he took in the mountains of Kurdistan and then in the mountains of Nuristan, which is in the far eastern part of Afghanistan. A very interesting person whom I still can't figure out entirely, because all I have to go on is really what he says, and sometimes he's self-contradictory.
What kind of an interior landscape do you find in Arabian Sands?
In the book, you mean?
Yeah, what kind of a psychological dimension? Are we all travelers? Is that what he's
saying?
No,
he's definitely different from others. Perhaps the strongest drive in his travels is getting away from the machine age. He hates it. He absolutely detests it. And he is seeking constantly places where he can get away from that. And I thought a very touching scene in his book is when he has returned from the sands, as the Arabs call it, and goes to the RAF base at Mukalla. Here he is with the RAF, the young pilots and so forth. He feels very strongly attached to them because they are English too. But he says, I have nothing in common with them. I am bored by what they are interested in.
Isn't this highly ironic that most of us think of machines when we think of travel?
Yes.
And here's somebody who underscores the exact opposite of that kind of notion.
And he says in another place, he says, if I could have done that by car and chose to do it by camel, that wouldn't have been the same thing. That would have been a stunt. But I'm doing it because it is what has to be done in that manner. And I think if he could have, you know, I think he would have preferred to have done it alone. But he couldn't. He had to have the Bedouin with him. He is very sensitive with them. Here is a man who, despite, I think, being a loner, is very sensitive to relations with other people. I think he got along with them beautifully, although he said the mental strain was much greater than the physical. And from his description, the physical was intense, so the mental strain must have been very, very severe.
It's been nearly 40 years since this book was published, or since the experiences in it occurred. Is it any easier for travel, for tourism? I'm not sure that travel is the same thing as tourism, but is it any easier nowadays?
Sure. Nowadays, you could cross the Rub al Khali, presumably in some of the sort of vehicles that the Arabian American Oil Company has for geological exploration or geophysical exploration. And he went back in 1977 and visited his companions. It wasn't the same thing. He said they move their camels from one pasturage to another by lorry. and they all have cars. And, you know, he said, it's gone. It's what he was after is totally gone.
Is the tourist the same thing as the traveler?
No, no. I don't think so. I think the traveler is seeking something within himself. I think Thesiger was out perhaps to prove something to himself, but he's never exactly clear what. Maybe he doesn't know, really. But the tourist is out to see other things and I think to come back and write about it or something like that. Thesiger, had no intention, apparently, of writing about this until he was talked into doing it. He certainly writes well. He is a very descriptive writer, and you really feel at times that you're there with him. Mm-hmm. It's very nice in that respect.
Let's talk about some of your interests in the Middle East. Politics and Islam, for instance. How did you get interested in that?
You can't really avoid it because politics and Islam, politics and religion are all the same thing. We in the West tend to divide this and talk about a secular way of life. Religion has its compartment in life. In Islam, it isn't that way. Mm-hmm. In Islam, everything has its... Religion is everything.
Americans have been accused of being insensitive to that.
Yes,
to that
yes.
Fact.
Well, we've been brought up so thoroughly in the opposite view that it's very difficult for us, for example, to understand that there is an Islamic way of brushing one's teeth.
Tell me about that.
Well, you do it with a stick of a particular kind, which is very fibrous, and the end of it is frayed, and that's your brush. It's known as a miswak. And this is simply an Islamic way of brushing your teeth, because this is where the Prophet Muhammad brushed his teeth, and you seek to do things as according to the Prophet's custom. Now, that's an extreme example, of course, and not every Muslim uses a miswak to brush his teeth, but it epitomizes the attitude that you want to do things in the way that they have been done in the past and that the way that God ordained that they should be done. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that you have to follow it by letter, although some Muslims do say that. I think nowadays more and more Muslims are saying we have to adjust to the modern way of life but retain the basic principles, the basic outlook, particularly the basic devotion.
Is that going to occur? The headlines daily seem to indicate that the Ayatollah is just not going to give an inch.
Right.
How is that process?
Here you have perhaps the extreme end of the pendulum. Mm-hmm. You had the extreme end in the other respect under the former Shah, where there was massive modernization, extreme modernization, with money simply poured in, and very self-destructive sort of modernization. Iran went from a country that produced its own food to one that had a heavy deficit in agriculture.
This was under the Shah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Under the Shah. And so when you have a pendulum that swings way over in one direction and there's a revolution, it's rather natural to understand that it's going to swing very far in the other direction before it begins to come down to a balance in between. Mm-hmm. But the Muslim people or friends that I know from, for example, Saudi Arabia, ones particularly in this country whom I talk with, are very concerned that such a fundamentalist revolution not occur there, if it can be avoided, but rather one where Islam is increased in devotion, in spiritual dimension. I have, for example, a graduate student who is writing a, not in my department, but I'm on the his committee, who's writing a dissertation on the Islamic perspective of development. How to develop Islamically. And what essentially he's talking about is putting a spiritual dimension into economic, political development.
Would this satisfy, or how far would this go to satisfy the demands of the current regime?
In Iran?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not very far, mm-hmm. because they would want to install a very Puritan regime in Iran because of what they'd seen on the other side of the balance mm-hmm. earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, Iran has been involved in relations, and not very happy relations, with the West for a long time to come. I mean, for a long time in the past.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, Putting Ideas into Circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
I'm talking with Dr. Herb Bodman, an historian who specializes in the Middle East and Islam from the University of North Carolina. Our discussion is about Iran, Islam, and their connections with the United States.
I always like to point out that in 1907, Tsarist Russia and Great Britain decided on how they would divide up Iran into spheres of influence, and the Iranians read about it in the newspaper. And, you know, put that in today's perspective, and it would be like Americans picking up the newspaper, or hearing more likely on television, that the Russians and the Chinese had divided the United States into three spheres, the Chinese having influence on the West Coast, the Russians on the East Coast, and the Mississippi River is a buffer zone. Would we like that? I don't think we would.
A lot of commentators seem to come back to a theme which is more or less as follows. If we understood the Iranians, if we had some grasp of Islamic culture, this would go a long way toward resolving our differences. Is it merely a question of understanding?
No, I don't think it's a question of merely of understanding, although that's the first step. I think from understanding of history, of background, of the kinds of awareness that they have that we lack, then there would be a realization of mistakes or of perspectives in the past where we weren't very considerate.
Mm-hmm.
We were out after something which we were going to get willy-nilly. For example, some large corporations, American corporations, that went in Iran, in partnership with very specialized Iranian interests who were out to feather their own nest, among which was the Pahlavi Foundation, the Shah's trust fund, which wanted a piece of many of the pies there in Iran, and the earnings of which presumably went out of the country.
Obviously, this process can't be reversed overnight.
No.
How does it occur? What's going to happen?
Well, I frankly feel dialogue is necessary. I was quite unhappy with the utter rejection by the president of Ramsey Clark's trip. Sure, it was sort of a loaded dice in the sense that he was going to a conference in which he knew, and we all knew, that the United States was going to be vilified. On the other hand, we did support the Shah in his violations of human rights. And the stories that come out of Iran these days on that are really shameful. I think we have something to admit, that we did do wrong. And that would be a start, certainly, towards a dialogue. I don't mean to get down and grovel on one's knees, but I don't think that's necessary. One can admit one makes mistakes with dignity. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time for us to realize that, in a sense, we have been an imperial power.
Well, given that kind of duty, given mm-hmm. that kind of responsibility, on the assumption that the United States comes clean mm-hmm. To the satisfaction of the Iranian people, what happens then? What politically, diplomatically, economically?
Yes, I would think the first thing would be a period of quiet. Mm-hmm. I don't think relations can be restored quickly. It's going to have to be a period of distance, of feeling out, of attempting on both sides to restore respect, mutual respect. We certainly, as a country, don't have it for the Iranians now. I see bumper stickers that horrify me, and I'm sure that the same thing is in Iran. There's an awful lot that's going to have to be rebuilt, and it's going to be a slow process. But perhaps through discussions of this sort, through inviting Iranian students back, not in massive numbers. In some cases, there were Iranian student enclaves at universities and colleges because the colleges wanted to make money. I can think of one in this state that had a serious problem with Iranian students because it got too many of them. And they weren't helping themselves, they weren't helping the Iranian students either, it seems to me. That, I think, will be part of the building process. Mm-hmm. I would hope that Iranians could express themselves in this country in time, and similarly we could do the same there.
If we can patch things up, aside from the obvious benefits, American foreign aid and Iranian oil, what do we stand to gain from one another? What benefits are there in the relationship?
Well, I look upon these as humanistic benefits. The Iranians are very talented people. They, aesthetically, they have a long tradition in art, in literature, in music, too. Perspectives on life are very often different from ours. To my mind, these differences are important for our own development, to understand our own development. I think we have to learn about other cultures, because if we do that, we develop a greater appreciation of our own, and we move ahead mm-hmm. in broadening our own cultural perspectives. We become better individuals if we understand and appreciate how people can be different and yet have mutual respect for each other. Mm-hmm. To me, this is critical. We're living in a world that is more mutually interdependent economically, politically, and yet socially, at times we seem to be moving farther and farther apart. This can lead to serious problems if what we do is, instead of developing greater appreciation for each other, develop a greater hostility. That's leading us down the path of self-destruction.
Let me ask you to elaborate that in a broader context. You are an historian. You make your living reading what's been written about how people live and in particular parts of the world. What good is history?
For one thing, it helps in perspective. History never repeats itself. That's one of the old saws, and that's perfectly true. And you don't learn things directly from history, but you do get, it seems to me, a great deal of vicarious experience out of history. And as I see it, you develop better judgment. To my mind, it's the learning from the experiences of others and then developing your own judgment on the decisions that you as an individual have to make. I am seriously disappointed in the attitude today amongst many students that history is bunk. Henry Ford, I could understand it with Henry Ford. He hadn't had any education, really. And that was a time when self-made men were the ideal. But that's not true nowadays. And it seems to me students are cheating themselves. For one thing, it's fun. We don't ask them any longer to memorize names and dates, although that's part of it. You have to have some facts. But what we're asking students to do these days is to develop judgment, put yourself in their place and say, okay, now what would you have done under these circumstances? And when they answer that, then you ask them the next question, well, are you really acting the way they would have acted, or aren't you putting some of yourself still into it? Can you really put on a whole new set of clothes and a whole new mentality too? Mm-hmm. And of course, in non-Western history, that's all the more difficult. A personal prejudice I have is that we teach a little too much American history and not enough non-American, non-Western. Mm-hmm. Because it's a vast population of the world. For example, 1 billion Muslims in the world. About 1 out of every 7 persons in the world is a Muslim. They're very different, but they all have something in common.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Ideas are the business of the National Humanities Center, and I'd like to invite you to listen for some of them on Soundings, a series of conversations with the men and women of the center. This week, Soundings looks at the Middle East, Islam, and their connections with America in a conversation with Dr. Herb Bodman, historian, scholar, and experienced camel rider from the University of North Carolina. I hope you'll be listening for Soundings.